Welcome, this is James Corbett. It is July 10th, 2012. You're tuned into CorbettReport.com, and today we have two guests on the line. We have Eric Dreitzer in the United States, and we have Niall Bowie in Malaysia, and we're going to be talking about Syria. So Eric and Niall, it's great to have both of you here.
Thanks, James.
Thanks for having me on, James.
All right, well, this is going to be a bit of a Syria roundtable, talking about some of the positive solutions that we can see in the seeming inevitable progress towards war and military intervention that's been laid out before us. Lots and lots of places to go with this. I'm not sure exactly where to start, but I know, Niall, you've been writing specifically about this quite a bit on Global Research and, of course, on your own blog at niallbowie.blogspot.com. So let's start with you, Niall, talking about scenarios for Syria, war, and stabilization. Perhaps you can run through some of the ideas that you brought out in that article.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I think the fact that the Russians and the Chinese have offered a veto to any kind of resolution enacting a military intervention in Syria, it allows analysts and people watching the situation to propose their own ideas in a way that they couldn't with the last conflict in Libya, for example. So last week, I think it was, I came up with this article, scenarios for Syria, basically foreseeing three possible scenarios. So I guess I'll read those off, and we can just sort of speculate from there. So the three scenarios that I've written up are as follows. So the first one would be Assad would ignore calls from the United Nations, calls for an interim government, the unity government plan that Kofi Annan has come up with recently, and he attempts to quell the insurgency by force. Now, this would reflect the conduct of nations such as Algeria, who have successfully been able to suppress insurgent activity that's been affiliated with AQIM in the region. Now, of course, this may work to further inflame the situation if outside forces were to increase their use of foreign mercenaries and to continue to provide rebel fighters with more dangerous armaments, including chemical and biological weapons. I'm sure both of you guys have seen the RT report warning of that a couple weeks back. Now, if Syrian security forces were unable to immediately restore order and crush this insurgency, basically, I think it would take any atrocity, whether it's manufactured or authentic, or perhaps an incursion into a neighboring territory of any of the countries around Syria, it may be enough to tip the scale in favor of military intervention with or without the approval of the United Nations. Now, if that occurred, I think we'd see the Turkish-Syrian border open up with quite open exchanges of fire, and Ankara would likely attempt to capture territory in northern Syria. If you've read the Brookings Institute memos, the Middle East memo that was released in March 2012, Saving Syria, Assessing Options for Regime Change, they specifically talk about, they elect Turkey as the nation who would begin to carve out areas of northern Syria for this proposed humanitarian corridor. And they suggest that this corridor, this safe haven, would be used to basically re-bolster the opposition, allowing them to apply further coercive action to basically topple the government there. So I think it's possible that Russia, Iran, China, they would likely condemn Turkey if that were to take place, and you have the potential of those nations opposed to regime change in Damascus offering some kind of solution to Assad. I think that's foreseeable. I think the government in Iran as well has offered support, military support, if foreign intervention were to take Damascus. So I think from that point, the potential for a wider regional conflict is really plausible. So do you guys want me to read the rest of them, or just do we want to discuss that solution first, or that scenario first?
I want to hear I personally would like to hear the rest of what you had, Niall.
Okay. Keep going.
Okay. So the second scenario that I foresaw here was Assad ignored the calls for the interim government, and he succeeded in quelling the insurgency by force. So I propose that this would cause rebel militants to disperse, to surrender, and to take refuge into rural areas and to neighboring countries as well. I think Syrian security forces would increase their operations in an attempt to maintain order in the population centers, and the military would likely aim to secure the tense regions, uh, the t- populated areas, and I think some form of normality would resume once that happens, although I think it's pretty likely that bombings and other, you know, small-scale attacks could persist. I think if that were to happen, Assad would really work to try and step up the internal security apparatus, and surely he would be portrayed as an international pariah in the media. I think Syria would likely still continue to suffer under economic sanctions. Assad also, if he were to continue to hold onto power in this scenario, if he failed to deliver reforms or any kind of political pluralism, I think internal dissent could again become problematic, and we could see moderates, shifting their support for the opposition. And I think if that happened, political turmoil would ensue. But I think the security situation could be stabilized if this insurgent activity is successfully subdued. And I think as an analyst watching this situation unfold, I think the goal for any analyst should be the immediate cessation of violence. And although I do point out later that all three of these scenarios, they do basically, civilian casualties will inevitably result from any of these three scenarios. Unfortunately, I think in the third scenario that I've proposed here would be that Assad accepts the calls for the interim government solution, and he submits his resignation, which I think it could potentially encourage insurgents to take advantage of that, very sensitive transitional period by increasing their operations against security forces and just continuing the months of this belligerent, violent activity. And I think if insurgents pushed forward with their campaign, they were able to maintain an upper hand in this kind of a sensitive political transition. It's possible they would be able to capture some territory in and around population centers. And surely, I think by that time, we'd see these armed groups persecute Assad loyalists, much like we've seen in Libya. Alawites, Shia, religious minorities, you have Christians, Druze, and whatever else. So, I think Libya is a great lesson of that happening, and that's ongoing in that country. And I think the interim government would really struggle to maintain the security situation and likely be unable to implement coherent policy, amid very obvious divisions in leadership. Although I do have to admit, I think if Assad had a place in the interim government, I think the situation could be a little bit different. But whatever sort of vision, whatever unity government is brought to the table, there are a lot of opposition parties in Syria, including the NCC. I forget what it breaks down to, the acronym, but this is a group that staunchly opposes foreign intervention. I remember Eric Dreitzer talked about it in his podcast as well. But I think in this scenario, political turmoil would ensue, and I think armed gangs as well would continue their campaign. I think we'd be sort of stuck in the same situation that we're in now, and I think this is really where Kofi Annan is really working to focus his efforts on this unity government solution. But I think a lot more has to be done, and I think the UN could do a lot more in terms of securing Syria's borders, inspecting incoming and outgoing cargo. Obviously, that would require a lot more manpower, but something as well I want to point out, which is very interesting. At the very beginning, both the opposition and Bashar al-Assad were completely opposed to this unity government plan, but as of last night, I was reading the Syria Live blog on Al Jazeera, and basically they posted a statement from Kofi Annan where he claims that Assad now backs the proposal of the unity government. And again, that's something he vehemently opposed just days ago. So if I can get some opinions on that.
Yeah, I think that that's an important point to make. The most recent developments that I've been looking at, and I agree with your analysis, Niall. I just to bring it into what we're seeing happening in, say, in the last 48 hours, the statements from the Russian government, from Putin on Monday, I thought were quite telling. Essentially, Putin is maintaining the same position that he's had all along, and that is that the situation in Syria must be solved by the Syrians and the Syrians alone. And one of the ways in which Russia is engaging with this particular perspective is by having separate dialogues with each of the various factions of the opposition and dialogue with the Assad government. So really, while Putin meets with one element of the Syrian opposition, Lavrov meets with another element of it. And so what we see then is moving in the direction of Russia, from my perspective at least, pressuring Assad to accept some form of power sharing through under the umbrella of this transitional government. Now, taking that one step further into, I guess, the solutions arena, which is really kind of what we're discussing here, it seems to me then that the transition government is only valuable insofar as it leads to elections, insofar as it leads to some kind of a democratization where the people of Syria have more of a say in what their government is going to look like. Now, I say that recognizing that Syria has had elections, the constitutional referendum, the elections where some of the parties outside of the Ba'ath Party did receive significant percentages from the people. But looking at it from a more Western perspective, the version of democracy that the United States is trying to impose is essentially one in which Assad is out forever. And this does not look to be realistic, because I think it's quite obvious that if Assad is removed from the equation, what we will end up seeing is civil war in Syria and a regional war. What we saw over the weekend with the Syrian National Council is that there is, from my end, no way that the Kurdish faction is going to work with the Syrian National Council and is going to work with the Muslim Brotherhood or is going to work with any of these other groups. And so what we will inevitably see then is the Kurdish faction breaking away in the absence of Assad and a wider regional war engulfing Turkey, engulfing northern Iraq, parts of Iran, and of course Syria as well. This, I think, is a nightmare scenario for all interested parties, including the United States, though the United States might have ulterior motives in wanting to foment something like this. So as a way of preventing it, as you mentioned, Niall, keeping the Assad apparatus in place while incorporating some of the other elements, I think that is really the way forward. And it seems to me that is what the Russians are working towards. I would also add, though, that in Syria, we did not have the Islamist parties allowed in these elections, I think for very good reason, because those Islamist factions, in particular, the Muslim Brotherhood and those who have sympathized with the Al-Qaeda death squads and all of the rest of the Western-sponsored elements that are wreaking havoc inside the country, those groups are there to destabilize. And it would be a self-defeating concept to allow them to be incorporated into an electoral process. So we're looking towards a democratization of Syria that is still at the same time selective, not entirely dominated by the Ba'ath Party, but not inclusive of the Muslim Brotherhood and the other Salafi groups and the various other radicals.
Well, I have to concur. I think that's probably the best that we could hope for in the situation as it's already developed. I mean, all we can hope for at this point is some sort of solution that will at least appease the sides enough to stop the violence and the killings, which is, of course, the main goal. But to a certain extent, allow me to be the gadfly, the nattering nabob of negativity in the conversation, and raise the question of the very implicit assumption in a conversation like this that a person here in Japan, a person in Malaysia, a person in the United States should be having, not obviously that you're saying that we should have a say over what's happening in Syria, but that it is somehow that this is something that international forces or something should have any sort of input into. And I think the entire idea of this international community coming together to hammer out a framework for what should be happening with the Syrian interim government in itself is part of the problem that underlies the entire situation.
Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. And there's an inherent inherent imperial hubris in all of this. I would venture to say that this is in and of itself an imperialist adventure. However, taking that aside, though, what we're looking at is the possibility of a full-scale regional war that could very easily become a world war, dragging the Chinese, dragging the Russians, who I think rightly so feel that really their interests are the ones that are being attacked. So while it seems insane that we or any of the so-called international community would be dictating to Syria what should happen in their country, let alone the fact that they have a so-called Friends of Syria meeting and don't even invite the Russians or the Chinese or the Iranians or the Syrians themselves. I mean, these type of perspectives, of course, we must discredit them. At the same time, I think that what we're talking about here are ways, possibilities of avoiding what could become, I mean, I hate to say it, but a world war.
Yes, certainly. And I think if we look at the Russian position on this issue, I think they've taken a really strong stance in terms of attempting to promote Syria's sovereignty in letting these internal forces, these domestic forces, come to the appropriate conclusions that they need to come to solve this crisis. And Putin as well, in his recent quote here I have in front of me, he said, "We must do everything in our power to coerce the opposition forces in the Syrian conflict to come to the table for a peaceful solution." So, as I mentioned before, it's not Assad who's actually opposed to this unity government plan as of last night. It's the opposition that is opposing these ideas, this unity government plan. And I think at this point, solutions are really important. And if we look at this conflict, this is a conflict where obviously this is fomented by outside forces completely. We see arms being smuggled in from every direction. And this is a conflict where toddlers have had their throats slit to the spine. I mean, it's heinous stuff. So I think in terms of solutions, what I've proposed is because we have this UN apparatus in place. I mean, for all of its shortcomings, that is the body on the ground. Even though our opinions I concur, it is a very imperialistic not even to invite the Syrians to the Friends of Syria conference. I mean, I think that's pretty ridiculous at this point. But what I think needs to happen in terms of approaching this with some solutions, first of all, we need to, well, not we, but representatives of the Syrian government and its allies, such as Iran, they should definitely have a place at future Friends of Syria meetings and any of these international mediation conferences to attempt to work towards a balanced solution to this crisis. And I think all efforts must be made to transition the Syrian people into a climate of normality, including the removal of economic sanctions, in a perfect world. Also, the United Nations must, I spoke about this on Russia Today the other day, they must investigate the nation states and institutions that are illegally smuggling arms into the country. I mean, that's a huge, if you're going to have a UN mission on the ground attempting to, restore order with the government in that country, it needs to be doing this, and that is just simply not being addressed. And as well, as I reiterated before, I think Syria's borders should be secured. I mean, the incoming and outgoing cargo is a big issue, and I think an arms embargo is not necessarily a bad idea if it was honestly implemented and both sides were able to respect that embargo. But I think what makes this situation so difficult is that you're going to have people on the ground, who whatever their motivations or ideological affiliations may be, who are going to continue to ferment violence in residential areas. And personally, I think, I'm not backing the Assad government by any means, but I think that a lot of these civilian deaths that we've had, this is a result of, shootouts, urban guerrilla warfare in populated residential areas. So you're getting, collateral damage. So this is what I think a lot of the civilian casualties can be attributed to.
Well, let me take both of your points on board. I certainly do concur. I agree very, very much so with what you're saying, that obviously this is a situation that is a reality on the ground. So we have to deal with it in some way. And since the framework that has been presented to us is this international, you know, negotiation type of framework, that's what we're dealing with. But I think what you point to is an interesting contradiction that's inherent in the process itself, insofar as they're using the language of negotiation and trying to bring Syria to the table, etc. But when we look at the Friends of Syria and the opposition, everything that they've done has been to undermine any attempt at negotiation. I mean, everything that has happened so far has been throwing that in its face. So from a real politic perspective, I just don't see how we could even really seriously contemplate the idea that there will be any type of negotiated settlement here. I think there's been absolutely nothing but bad faith demonstrated by the opposition and the so-called Friends of Syria, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. I mean, they've made it perfectly apparent that the only possible outcome to this is the complete removal of Assad.
You go on, Eric.
Sorry. Yeah, James, I agree with you on that point. I would only add, though, that political realities change as the priorities of the interested parties change. And what we're seeing is, from as far as I can tell, the United States, the Obama administration, with the Hillary Clinton and Susan Rice and the rest of these imperialists, these warmongers, they're looking for ways to save face. I think that the attempt or the belief was that they would have long since toppled Assad, and that they would have already long since moved on to whatever their next target was going to be, whether that was Iran, whether that was other parts of Africa, who knows. But what's happened is, it seems to me that they have seen nothing but failure after failure after failure, trying to provoke a war with the Hula massacre, trying to provoke a war with the downing of the Turkish jet, trying to arm the so-called Free Syrian Army. And what we see is the Free Syrian Army is a feckless gaggle of lunatics who can't work together in any coordinated fashion. What we've seen is that Turkey, despite as much prodding as we have seen, has not instigated a war with Syria. So it seems to me that a lot of the avenues that the imperialists have tried to undermine everything that's happened in Syria have sort of been closed to them. So I'm being slightly optimistic here, but I'm seeing a movement towards where the Obama administration, in an election year, is going to need to figure out some way to resolve this crisis without engaging in a full-scale war, because I don't think that that is in their interests. Now, whether there's some sort of a false flag provocation or something along those lines, entirely possible, but at this point, it seems to me that the U.S. is looking for some way to save face without having to admit that they were defeated. At the same time, the Russians are looking for some way to alleviate the international pressure that's been put on them, as well as perhaps to a lesser extent the Chinese. So it is possible that the climate is such that we could see some kind of a negotiated settlement. All of that being said, though, everything you said is correct. All of the parties of the so-called opposition, whether they be external as the Syrian National Council or the Free Syrian Army, or internal with the National Coordinating Committee, the NCC, and some of the other groups, they have done everything they can to undermine any attempts at peace, whether it was the initial ceasefire, the Kofi Annan plan, the observer mission, or what we're seeing now. So I think that right now is a critical juncture in this entire conflict, and what happens, say, in the next week to 2 weeks is going to be very significant to what happens for the next year. Because if we can see a movement towards some kind of a negotiated settlement, it seems to me that puts the brakes on what the United States and the Western imperialists have attempted to do in the Middle East vis-a-vis Iran, vis-a-vis the Arab Spring, and all of the rest of this wave of destabilizations.
I think with respect to the settlement, the interim government solution, that is something I proposed in early June in my article, Searching for Solutions in Syria, and it's being brought to the table now, so I'm happy with that. And I think that needs to that certainly needs to be emphasized, and I think that's the best prospect for a kind of a coming to terms with this insurgency and looking at ways to, where it can be quelled. I think if we look at Kofi Annan, who again has paid lip service to the plan, I think he has disproportionately laid the blame on the Syrian government in so many ways. And if we look at his conduct in different parts of the world. Look at the Rwandan genocide, for example. You had the UN, the Canadian UN peacekeeper on the ground, General Dallaire. Now, he had an opportunity. We know in Rwanda that the forces on the ground, they knew that this genocide was going to take place. You know, they had significant foreknowledge of this ethnic tension in Rwanda, and they had an opportunity to basically invade the not invade, but to storm the Hutu Interahamwe militia, the extremist Hutu militia's weapons cache. So this is machetes and all of these things, and they had the opportunity to do so, and they were told to stand down by the UN. Now, had they done that, you know, on the ground there, it would be beyond their mandate. But had they done that, that would have saved a lot of people's lives, I think. And it brings up scenarios like that. Bring up, you know, all of these different questions, such as you know, R2P and interpreting the mandate of these kinds of operations. I mean, how do you guys feel about that? And what more can be done? I mean, as Eric mentioned, all of these provocations and things that have been, the Syrian government has been credited with, and that simply don't add up. I mean, with the exception of the Turkish jet, I mean, that's something different. And I think the Turkish government was acting outside of international law. So I think that's settled. But things like the Hula massacre, you know, as many analysts have pointed out, that does not reflect, that is not characteristic of Syria. That this has a lot to do with the kind of conduct, the kind of massacres and killings that have taken place in Iraq, particularly the Anbar province. So just with respect to what I just said, you guys have any feedback on that?
Well, I think that what you're pointing to, the historical precedent with Rwanda, I think that's true. I have tried to examine what's happened in Syria in the context of the Balkans and the development of what happened in the Balkans, because in fact the intervention that took place there was predicated, much the same as we see in Syria, on these so-called massacres, many of which were debunked, many of which were manufactured. They were manufactured for the purposes of instigating an intervention. With that in mind, I think that the intervention, from my perspective, is becoming less and less likely, simply because I just don't see the international community really kind of rallying behind this idea. And I'm not just talking about Russian and Chinese opposition. I frankly don't see the will for it in many other parts of Europe, despite the bellicose language of the French or of the Germans or of whoever. I'm not convinced that they're willing to take it on. Frankly, they are outmatched. They are NATO is spread very, very thin, including what is happening in Afghanistan, what they did in Libya, what's happening all over the world. So military intervention to me is becoming less likely. What is more likely, though, is is stepping up the aid to the terrorist networks through their proxies in Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the United Arab Emirates, stepping that up, which really is precipitating these bloodbaths, this increase in violence. And the fact that this opposition is so unwilling to really deal in any practical solutions makes me fearful that what we'll see is continued bloodletting and the undermining of any possible peace deal. But I want to take this conversation, if I could, one step, maybe, you know, take it back a ways and start to think about, what does Syria represent for a broader context? In other words, what does this conflict tell us about the nature of geopolitics in the world today? Because the conflict, as I've mentioned on my program and, you know, many others have as well, the conflict in Syria is so much bigger than Syria. It's a national one in the country. It's a regional one that engulfs the Iranians and the other regional actors. But it's also an international one that really, I think, plays into the idea of the battle for influence between the United States and U.S. military power projection around the world, and on the other side, the rise of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the BRICS, or the you know, the Russians and the Chinese more generally. What does Syria tell us about this? I would point to the going back a few decades. What was the non-alignment Pact, we saw many countries which refused to align themselves with either imperialist power of the time, refusing to align themselves directly with the United States, refusing to align themselves with the Soviet Union at a time when you had a bipolar world. Well, in this unipolar world that we're living in, it seems to me that we are now on the verge of a moment where countries and groups of countries can come together and kind of coalesce around certain ideals, certain principles, the ideals that the Russians have been standing up for in Syria: territorial integrity, national sovereignty, international law. In other words, putting a stop to the imperialist rampage that the United States has been waging around the world, at least for the last 20, 25 years. I think that is where the Syria conflict really lends value to analysts and to interested observers around the world.
I would love to believe that there are going to be those types of blocks formed around ideas and principles like standing up for territorial sovereignty. But to be honest, I do see, of course, that that Russia and China and the SCO countries, or however you want to frame that group that's forming an opposition to this sort of NATO interventionism, I do see that being that type of bulwark against those NATO led principles of violating other sovereignty and stepping in and meddling. But I don't believe that, maybe I'm being cynical here, but I don't believe fundamentally that's motivated by any type of true idealism or any type of political philosophy. I honestly think it's about economic incentive and realism in terms of the geopolitical chessboard and what they can get out of countries. And I think China realizes that they can get much more out of Africa, for example, by cooperating with African countries and governments and not getting involved in their politics rather than getting involved in them. So I do agree. I certainly think that we are moving away from the unipolar world into the multipolar world. But I think that those types of alliances and things that are going to form are going to be more about convenience, more about economics than about principles or standing on any type of political philosophy.
Exactly. And what James mentioned just now, I mean, China is the biggest player in Africa, namely because they offer the African countries something. They're seen as a partner to those African countries who have been historically exploited by the colonial powers. So the Chinese, they come in with proposals to build roads, to build bridges, infrastructure, universities, hydroelectric power plants, and this is crucially what Africa needs. And they're offering something far more tangible. And I think with respect to what Eric said, if we look at the Syrian conflict, it presents an exhibition of just so many methods that the Western countries and their allies are using to forcefully destabilize a nation, especially if we look at the media apparatus, for example. I reported in my article that I referenced a report in Time magazine that had mentioned that $72 million had been budgeted to train the rebels in producing videos and things like that, using YouTube and hacking and things like that, to train the Syrian rebels to bypass internet technology that the Assad regime had in place. And then we see things like the Syrian news agency report rebels are fabricating videos using fake blood and things like that. I've seen many YouTube videos come out of Syria at the moment where people are seemingly looking dead, that they have the white veil over them, and then they laugh and things like that. So there's a lot of fabricated footage coming out. If we look at Terry Masson's report as well, where he reported the construction of sound stages and things like that in the Doha studios of Al Jazeera. I mean, these reports really shocked me to such a large extent. And it reflects the meticulous kind of attempts to cultivate this false image, to use every apparatus. And I think the Syrian conflict is very interesting, mainly because I think the media has become an entirely separate battlefield, to wage war in support of their version of reality.
Yeah, I agree with that absolutely. I wanted to return to what James said, though, because I think the point that he made was spot on. I'm not suggesting that Russia and China and other countries like that would be taking these positions for idealistic reasons. I think that would be incredibly naive. This is, of course, motivated by their own economic interests and their own geopolitical interests. However, the language that is used, the arguments that are made in the court of public opinion, I think are very significant. The establishment of a precedent that no, you cannot trample on these principles such as sovereignty and territorial integrity and the rest of them, I think that that's quite important, because that's something that has gotten lost in the narrative of geopolitics of the last 30, 40 years. That there was a time when those principles, though they were violated both by the United States and the Soviet Union, that they still held some sway, I guess, with public opinion and with the opinion of analysts around the world. I think that today, much less so, an entire generation has come of age under this unipolar world where the United States really is not subject to these international laws and these precedents. So I guess that's the point that I'm making, that the reestablishment of these principles, at least as the argument, at least as the public face of what the Russians and the Chinese are doing, because absolutely they're very much self-interested, self-motivated, and they're going to be doing what is in their own economic interest. For the Russians, of course, access to the Mediterranean Sea, their base at Tartus, their arms sales to Syria, as well as, of course, trying to diminish American dominance in the region as much as possible. For the Chinese, as Niall mentioned, in Africa, as well as what their interests are in South Asia, consolidating their power in the South China Sea, preventing the United States from blocking them in those areas as well. So the geopolitical aspect of this, the reality of it, is of course where I think the meat of the issue is. But on the face of it, these values I think are important, and to reestablish them, at least in the public mind, is a tremendous step in the right direction, the direction of progress and peace.
Niall, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I certainly agree with what Eric is saying, and I think it's interesting. I had pointed out in my last conversation with you, James, that I think the Syrian conflict has separated the world, you know, more or less along Cold War lines. But nowadays, it's referred to as the NATO bloc, the IMF bloc, whatever you want to call it, and the Shanghai Cooperative Organization. And I think these are values that are, Eric said it best, are very important. And I think after Libya, I think there is a tremendous requirement to bring these ideas back to the table in terms of conflict diffusion and things like that. And I think some of the other things I had mentioned in my article, that things that the United Nations could do to emphasize more on the ground, I think what we really need to emphasize on is the establishment of arms-free zones in these population centers. I think that is a very crucial step that the United Nations has to take, and I think Kofi Annan is making a mistake at the moment in emphasizing completely on the establishment of this unity government, and the observers are no longer going out into the field and observing and doing their job, and from recent media reports, it seems like violence is increasing in these neighborhoods and things like that. And there's a lot of the same things that we've seen since the beginning of this crisis: a very one-sided, disproportionate blaming of the Syrian government for a lot of these issues. And as I had mentioned in my interview with Russia Today, I was reading on Al Jazeera 2 days ago these threats that Hillary Clinton had made to Russia and China for that they would pay the price for supporting the Assad regime. And the very next article was a warning from the Iraqi government talking about how that jihadist fighters, terrorist fighters, were crossing into Syria, and that needs to be looked at. And there's no editorial connection between these two crucially important stories. It's just amazing to see what's going on there at the moment.
Well, I must admire your credulity at the media in terms of your surprise that they would be used in this form. I think this.
I'm not surprised. It's right. Just like it's so disenfranchising. You know? Well,
it is because exactly right. This is absolutely the one of the key methods of control over any society, and certainly comes into play in every war and conflict. The use of the media. So we're running out of time here. Only a few minutes left. Just on the final note, I want to ask you guys your opinion on the future of Syria qua Syria. I mean, not thinking about the international situation, but internally, what are we looking at here in terms of the sectarian strife that is clearly at the base of so much of the conflict that's being fueled from the outside? And do you think that we are seeing any way out of the possibility of a breakup of the country, if not physically, in terms of dividing the country up along sectarian lines, at least in some key sense that the country will never be able to be united again in the way that it formerly was.
Eric, do you want to take that?
Sure. Well, I think that that's a very real possibility. The integrity of Syria is very much at stake here. Syria, I would say even to a much larger degree than Libya, is a fragmented country. Disparate groups, many of which have their interests that are not aligned with each other. For example, the Christian minority in Syria is very afraid of what a future is going to look like without Assad, because frankly, I think it's quite likely that what we would end up with is a Sunni radical government that would take power in the absence of an organized Assad apparatus. They would seize power, and you would see a bloodbath of the Alawites, a bloodbath of the Christians, and then what would inevitably become the breakaway of the Kurdish group, which would not only create civil war within Syria, it would essentially create civil war in Turkey as well. So this becomes a regional war. The issue of the unity of the country, I think, is central to everything that we're going to see from here on out, because at this point, I think that is the primary concern for those interested parties that we mentioned. The Russians, it's not about Assad. It's not about anything other than their own interests, as we've already mentioned. And their interests dictate they have to have a unified Syria, because without that, the base at Tartus becomes meaningless, and Russian power in the region really takes a major hit. And in terms of on the ground in Syria, it's not just going to be civil war. We will see ethnic cleansing on a scale much greater than in Libya, and we will see a legacy of the destruction of that country far worse than what's happening in Libya right now, where they've descended into warlordism, tribalism, and absolute chaos and misery for the people there. In Syria, that is the future if they cannot create a transitional government that incorporates Assad and the Ba'ath Party and some of the other parties, because I don't see any other way out of it.
Completely agree with you, Eric, there. And just to sort of conclude here, I think that whatever needs to happen in Syria, Syrians need to decide it. It needs to be something that they decide themselves. And I think that can only happen once the immediate cessation of violence takes place. And I think the United Nations really needs to work on this plan, to work towards this transitional unity government. But as well, I think I don't think we can really expect too much out of this plan if they are going to continue disproportionately laying the blame on the Syrian government. And I think right now, I think we really need to demand that the United Nations, at least at minimum, investigate some of these arms smugglings that have been taking place in and around Syria's borders. And also, I read a statement from Kofi Annan the other night where he, for the first time, I've seen him actually criticize those countries who are providing material assistance to the rebel forces. In the form of, he said they were undermining the plan, and that's completely right. So I think the situation on the ground is really tense, and I think at minimum, I think Assad is justified in at this point attempting to quell this insurgency by force, because a lot of what they constitute is war crimes. They're war crimes against the people of Syria, and I think it's very difficult for me to look so far into the future as any incident can completely change the situation, but as Eric had mentioned before, I think what's going to happen over the next several weeks is really going to decide the situation for the next year or so, the next several months. And I think at this point, it's extremely important to keep a close eye on what's going on in terms of these negotiations. And as Putin said, even coercing these opposition groups to cooperate into this peace plan. And I think before any political compromise can be arrived at, I think the immediate cessation of violence needs to be realized.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We're fresh out of time, but it has been a fascinating conversation. Let's just direct people to your websites and your offerings. We'll start with Niall.
Okay, it's nilebowie.blogspot.com, but I contribute quite regularly to Global Research and as well Global Research TV, so there are a number of different websites where you can check out some of my writings and materials.
That's right, and as you mentioned before, you were recently on RT, so hopefully more we'll see you there more often as well. And Eric, how about you?
Well, my website is stopimperialism.com. I do a weekly podcast, the Stop Imperialism Podcast. I took a brief break for the last 2 weeks or so, but we're back on schedule. People can check out episode 29 of the Stop Imperialism Podcast. It should be out in the next 48 hours since we're recording on Monday night. And also, I'm a contributor to the Center for Research on Globalization. I'm a regular contributor on RT as well. And you'll probably see me on RT at some point in the next 4 or 5 days. I'm not sure when it'll come out. So people just check stopimperialism.com regularly and you'll see all of the information there.
All right, gentlemen, thank you for your time today, and I hope to talk to you again soon.
Thanks,
James.